Welcome to the Angus Table, the podcast from Angus Australia. I'm Scott Wright, the CEO at Angus Australia. Each episode will bring conversations with breeders, industry leaders, innovators, insights, stories and ideas that matter and hopefully add value to your Angus operation. Whether it's genetics, markets, pasture management, marketing experts or people shaping the breed, this is where the Angus community pulls up a chair at the Angus Table. Thanks for joining us. Well, this morning we're joined by a very special guest to the Angus Table, our market forecaster in Simon Curley. You're one of the most energetic forecasters that I know. Welcome to the Angus Table, Simon.
Thanks, Scott. Lovely to be here.
You bring an amazing energy to your role and an enthusiasm, Simon. We've had you speak at the Angus Conference. We've had you come to our board meetings, give a bit of guidance there. We've shared meals, which we've enjoyed. And you come to our Gen Angus program every year to invest in our young people. You're well known to our members, and probably the climax this year was you spoke at our World Angus Forum. So you're very much part of the Angus family, and you've been very positive about the Angus breed and its future. I think this year you must feel fairly good, Simon, having predicted the lamb high in Australia. You're right on the money.
Yeah, thank you, Scott. Yeah, no, it is good. Look, I think the key is, you know, it's all well and good to get the next 6 months right on forecasting, but I think it's really trying to paint the picture for the next 3 years, even 5 years, on where we see trends heading. Because to me, Scott, it's about the investment today on farm that comes to fruition in 3 years' time, more so than the short-term decision. So getting the strategy right is where my true interest lies. And so as we go forward here, I'd love to talk about some of those trends. But, you know, my experience is that for farmers, for Angus producers, they need to understand not just the immediate, but the medium to long-term trends and where we're heading.
Thanks, Simon. That's great. We might delve into a little bit of your background, Simon, to start with. It's a job probably that not many people stick their hand up for, is to try and have a go at predictions of where the markets are going for a red meats. And not an easy job at all, Simon. But where did it begin for you, Simon? How did your career and your love for agriculture start out?
Well, Scott, I'm the son of two medical doctors. So you might say we just stayed in the meat industry, just a different form of meat. So grew up in Shepparton, and I did an ag science degree at Melbourne University. Had a year in India in the mix of all that, Scott. Went looking for myself, and I'm still looking. And then got into the Victorian Farmers Federation and truly loved the political side of things. So having to research, understand topics, it was just very, very interesting, and then trying to make change. And during that period was Ausmeat and Calm was where things were starting to happen. So I was truly in a role of bridging between farmers and processors in Victoria. And to me, that was where my love affair with the meat industry began. And then I went and worked for Louis Dreyfus in 1989 and pretty well remained in the meat industry ever since, trading meat in particular. So 35 years of trading and brokering beef, lamb, mutton around the world. So today, Scott, not only do I do the analyzing, but I also broker Indian buffalo out of India into America for pet food. So should any of your Angus members want a container load of cooked spleen or udders, I'm happy to deliver that next week if need be.
It's one of the most interesting product recommendations I think I've ever heard. Did that come out of your time in India, Simon?
It didn't. It's actually as I've spent a lot of time both living and trading North America. So we lived there for a period. No, good friends of mine in the industry said, you are very familiar with India. Would you mind stepping into this space? And that was about 7 years ago. But having spent so much time there amongst my various suppliers, it's rare that everyone at the board table I can identify with their hometowns, where they're from, and everything about India. So I truly come to the table with an understanding of their culture.
That's excellent, Simon. A question I did have for you, and that's a great jumping off point, was you've traveled a lot around the world, haven't you? I gather most parts of the red meat industry in a lot of countries. How's that sort of travel, both professionally and personally, formed your view of, I guess, people and culture around the world and your impact on your business?
Yeah, it's crucial, Scott. So I'm truly a believer that you've got to visit and be in the market to understand the market. So having lived in America for a year, but traveled, you know, when had my own trading business and but for large international companies that I've worked for, we would always be visiting clients across the world and getting down into the nitty-gritty of understanding what the market needs were. So Indonesia, Japan, China, Hong Kong, South America, North America, Europe, we've been it to all of them and love it. And today I still get to India, of course, because of meeting suppliers. But last year I was in South America, spent 3 months looking very closely at trying to understand what drives South America, the type of product, how big a competitor they are. So all these things, I truly believe if I'm not trying once a year to get to a market, I'm not doing my job.
Yeah, interesting. There's a lot of research goes on in that background, and I can only imagine how crucial that is in your role to understand, especially our competitors in the market.
Yeah, do not underestimate our friends in South America, in particular Brazil.
Mm. We'll get to some markets a little bit later on. When you're not analyzing charts and trade flows or trading buffalo udders, how do you switch off and what do you enjoy doing, Simon?
Well, I am captain of our local tennis team and, fronting up every Monday afternoon or evening to play tennis. I've got to say each year my skill set gets slightly, not as good as the previous year. But I think I make up for it in the banter on the court. And my wife and I, we are avid walkers, so we're doing the Three Capes in Tasmania, bushwalk, the first week of December. Three children as well, tends to keep us pretty busy. Yeah, what do I say? Exercise is a big part of what we do outside of work.
That's great, Simon. What sort of keeps you grounded? Everything, deep philosophy or, you've got a bit of a challenging intellectual life. Yeah, what's it? What keeps you
My grounded? Wife keeps me grounded, Scott. Whenever she thinks I'm getting ahead of myself, she'll pull me down and say, Simon, we live in a very lovely community. My wife's 90-year-old parents live next door. Every Thursday evening, we have three 90-year-olds for dinner. We are continually surrounded by family, and I think that keeps us grounded.
Family's pretty important to a lot of our listeners, I think, and the Angus community generally is based around family farms. So that's really good. What about in terms of value, Simon? What do you hold pretty close to your heart in terms of guiding your work well?
I think truth is probably what I value the most. So often, Scott, when we're looking at the markets in particular, and sometimes there's a lot of noise in the market, and part of what I like to do is to truly pull it apart and say, that's not really the reason why this market is going up or down, but here are the reasons. So only last week, we wrote a paper and put out our own podcast, and we titled it Mythbusters, in which we went through a lot of claims in today's market that simply were not true. And I think it's important to keep peeling back the layers and trying to find the truth so that we all make better decisions.
There's certainly a lot of chatter at times in this game, I think, in the cattle and beef industry, that there may or may not be certain pressures or cycles at times. So very important for you to cut to the chase, I guess.
You bet.
You'd be one of the great readers, wouldn't you, that you read a lot of material every day. Do you have any books that we should put on our shelves?
On your to-do list? It's a good question. I think, Scott, probably I always enjoy the classics. Look, where do I start? We love murder mystery. My wife and I, we love mysteries. And so I guess, once again, it's always seeking the truth.
That's great. On a trip I've just started Simon, reading Winston Churchill's The History of an English-Speaking People, again, in four volumes, and I've read it before, but it's a pretty good grounding work to think about where we've come from as a society. So, yeah, good thing, Simon. Any great mentors in your life that have shaped who you are?
Yeah, I think there's been many, right from when I was at school to today, and there still are. But if I was thinking about when I first started way back at the Victorian Farmers Federation, you know, the Bill Bodmans of this world, and some people may or may not remember Bill, Kevin Scheel and others that were all very much a cornerstone of what was happening. Recently, you know, I've got to know and appreciate Andrew Robb, our former trade minister, who spoke at our conferences, if you remember. And Andrew has been, you know, there as good guidance. Then I fast forward to my time at ConAgra, Brent Eastwood, who's now CEO of JBS, really played a pivotal role in my life. Louis Dreyfus, we had many really good leaders there. And then right up to today, dare I say, my business partner in America, Brett Stewart, is both a good friend and I'd say mentor to me every day.
That's fantastic. I actually was very impressed with Andrew speaking at your conference in Brisbane this year. I think it was probably one of the best talks that I've heard for a while from someone that's got a deep understanding of trade relationships, free trade agreements. He didn't pull any punches on Mr. Trump, did he?
It was
a very good talk, and it was nice. He put on a couple of drinks afterwards, and I had the pleasure of meeting him later, which, yeah, very quite a deep individual. I didn't quite realise, so I can see why you put him on your list.
Yeah, no, he's outstanding.
You recently completed a Churchill Fellowship, looking at methane and carbon. That's a deep dive. It was months of work. What did that teach you personally?
So that was really interesting, Scott, because I think the whole importance of obviously the environment, but also the carbon farming space about market access, I truly believe going forward, this is going to be part of everything we do. What were some of the findings of my 3 month study and trip around the world? There is no premium for carbon neutral beef. And I think, Scott, that doesn't change, that the marketplace expects that it just becomes part and parcel of everything we do. Yet today, we should not just think about market access, but we now have to think about company access. So by that, I refer to large processing companies will require under ESG, environmental social governance, that you now as a farmer or a producer supply your carbon footprint details. Basically, you need to baseline your property. And I think that to understand that this is important, that you can actually do it very cost effectively. In actual fact, it can cost you zero in terms of cost, but you need to do it. What we saw on our travels, though, was where I think the methane situation should be. I truly believe that farmers, if they're being asked to right the wrongs of those that live in the city, which we are, then we need to be paid for that. So farmers need to be rewarded almost as a separate income stream. You have this situation that you have to fix. You're being asked to go beyond the call of duty. Therefore, what am I going to be paid? What we learned is that in places like California, which works, that the landing point, or you might say the rent from meeting your goals in this space, should be somewhere around $200 to $250 per animal per year. So that is where ultimately we need to head in terms of meeting targets for methane reduction. And that's the size of the reward that's required per farmer, per animal, I believe, to get the right result if we're going to right the wrongs of those in the city. I won't go into the details of a mechanic of how that's set up and the trading platform required. The end point to get the right result is a certain amount of money per animal required. And now I know, I think, where that money, that landing point is.
The big figure, Simon. That's a lot of money.
If you want a lot of change, that's the type of money you have to pay.
I can only imagine that's significant, and that would have to be foremost in a lot of policymakers' thinking going forward, Simon, at a government level and, agri-polity level as well.
It is, and sometimes when you come up with concepts, you may be ahead of the curve a little in some of these. And so I think at some point in the future, what we'd like is methane to be separated from CO2 and that ability to then measure methane on its own and reward methane on its own is, I think, where we need to head.
Interesting, Simon. Some of our listeners might need to attend one of your events to get a deeper dive. That's fantastic. Simon, let's walk through your career. Started with Victorian Farmers Federation, and then you've had a progression through a number of meat processes, and then we'll get to global agri-trends in a minute. But yeah, do you want to talk us through that, some of those roles?
Sure. So, trading is all encompassing. And I think what I've enjoyed is having that enormous array of markets in which to trade, but also the ups and downs of a market. So being able to, understand why a market goes down, collapses, oversupply, and versus undersupply during a rebuild, for example, Scott. And so some of the trends that we see in Australia today, I've watched for 35 years, and instinctively, when I see things written by others, it does infuriate me because I've watched these patterns for years and spent time and money and effort to understand them. So as we went from one trading company to another, and then I had my own for a good 10 years, I guess you become almost second nature in your blood about understanding flows, markets, pricing, risk. And risk is probably the most important thing of all to really understand, and what drives people in their decision-making. So in the last 5 years or so, 6 years, Brett Stewart and I came together to form Global Agritrends. Prior to that, Scott, I'd spent 5 years visiting America 3 times a year, trading swaps or brokering swaps across America with all the large processing and importing companies in America, with a company in Australia called Merricks Capital. And we would be, I'd say, brokered in a good year, 50, 60,000 tons worth of swaps. So it was very insightful. It re-engaged me with enormous parts of North America on a day-to-day basis. And also importantly, it made me try and truly understand where risk is in America from their point of view. So in the process, African swine fever came to China and wiped out 2/3 of the population of China's pigs. And so during 2017, 18, 19, I spoke across many parts of America, Asia, Australia on this subject. And lo and behold, shared the platform with Brett Stewart, who had established at that stage Global Agritrends for about 12 years. And I said, that guy's good. So we joined forces and set up Global Agritrends in Australia 6 years ago. And Scott, the rest is history.
It's an interesting partnership, Simon. To go back a step there, in 1996 and 1997, I worked in Singapore for Singapore Food Industries, and there was a meat buyer, Daisy Wu, and she would be sitting a few desks away from me, and every day she was on the phone to beef and lamb salespeople from Australia and New Zealand and further afield from the US, Canada. And now I think who one of those people that she would have been talking with, it would have been a younger Simon Curdy on the phone trying to make a sale.
Somewhat annoying, I'm betting, but anyway, yes.
Great. I've seen you a number of times at your global agri-trend events. You do have to both have a synergy, and you seem to just have a great rapport and bounce off each other. Different, but similar. Yeah, how does it look under the hood It sounds like you've got a great partnership, Simon.
Yeah, no, Scott, it's an absolute pleasure to be with Brett. And we talk all week, even though in some ways we run completely separate businesses because I look after Australia, he looks after America. But we compare notes, and then every weekend we sit down together and we prepare our podcast that goes out on a Monday morning. And if anyone says podcasts are easy, then they're kidding themselves. We would spend each probably 6-7 hours prepping and then another 4-5 hours sitting together working out how we want to deliver that week's podcast called Monday Thoughts for the Week. And so, Scott, there is a good 12 to 15 hours worth of work between us in each podcast. But when you're with somebody as good as Brett, it's pretty easy to spend that time together. So the answer is that I think, you know, friendships are often a very good basis to a lot of these partnerships that on the surface look very easy, but I guess they can be difficult, but good friends somehow get to resolve all those differences.
That's interesting. Obviously, you can't give too much away, but it's a secret sauce in global agri-trends. But how do you go about collating that information? And there's a lot of data you've got to get your hands on. Is it, you know, 50 phone calls leading up to that podcast? Is it analysing data? Yeah, give us a sense of the types of sources you might use, Simon.
Well, Scott, it feels like I've never changed my job. So when I was trading, it was the same thing. You presented with, you know, facts and figures, data, and then you spend your time talking to others to try and interpret them in the way you think's meaningful. And then from there, you can make decisions about either to buy or sell. In this instance, we're not buying or selling, we're delivering information. But at that point of delivery, we've completely looked at the numbers, questioned them ourselves, gone out seeking the answer to the, you know, problem or trying to understand it. So talking to lots of people and then coming up with your conclusions. It's no different to trading.
It's a fascinating one, Simon. Those who haven't attended one of Simon's conferences or events might be surprised to know that there's no one. You don't just sit quietly in the crowd, and if you're somebody that's an industry person that might have some knowledge, Simon gives you a microphone and asks you some hard questions. I always find that fascinating, Simon. The people, they're pretty good with their information, aren't they?
They are very
happy.
Yeah, yeah. And I think, Scott, that's one of the nice things about that conference, is that we are talking to people up and down the supply chain in the one room. So you've got farmers, you've got backgrounders, you've got livestock agents, and I think the best of the best, feedlotters, meat processors, banks, industry organisations like yours, everyone's in the one room, and we put up our thoughts and views, hear their thoughts and views. As you know, there's been arguments in the room almost, or we haven't got to fisticuffs, but people are passionate and it's good to bring that out of them and to hear their thoughts and ideas. So, Scott, every year I think the conference gains more momentum, a lot more people come along, and I think it's that interaction that people love is hearing from all parts of the industry on where they believe things are heading and their thoughts and ideas. So, yep, it's a unique opportunity.
It is unique. And you know, I had a little smile on my face. I think it was your conference on the Gold Coast, and some of us that are a bit more aligned to the livestock sector, where you had a processor actually challenge you on your price forecast. And it was good because you were able to wrestle with that in public over the microphone. And he said, look, I don't think you're right. And you said, look, these are my assumptions. This is why. And some other people in the room interacted. And I think for those of us more livestock focused, it was really healthy to actually have that banter and go, okay, so there's different trains of thought here. And there was a smile on a few cattle producers' faces there. At the same time, it was quite an interesting interchange.
Yeah, I love it. It's, you know, the more banter and discussion we can have, the better.
That's great. What's some of the big trends you've seen? You know, if you go back over the last 20 years, What's some of those macro changes that you think are quite pivotal to the industry, Simon?
Yeah, it's a good question. So the one recent one that is of so much interest to me, Scott, is the fact that now the southern processing capacity for cattle in Australia in the south, and that's New South Wales, Victoria, South Australia, for the first time in 20 years, now exceeds that of the north. So for the first 20 years or so before this recent occurrence, the south and the north were almost identical in capacity. Then in the last 18 months, we've seen meatworks in Cootamundra, as you know, down in Gippsland, Tongala, TFI and Murray Bridge. Bricks and mortar expansion has occurred. And as a result, today, it's about a 15% increase that South has over the North in terms of capacity, kill capacity. On top of that, we had that extraordinary situation during COVID where the number of workers in Australia with 457, 486 visas collapsed. And so, you know, back in 2020, 21, which led into 23, workers were below 40,000, 50,000 people in the country. Today, they're at 120,000. So we've more than doubled, and therefore capacity, both in bricks and mortar and in people, truly are back in shape. So the trend is that now that there is more capacity in the south than the north, as we go into a rebuild, which I firmly believe will start early next year, the pull from the south, the demand, the pricing out of the south will be strong to try and fill those shackles because of that larger capacity that exists. So for southern operators, you know, the majority of Angus lives in southern Australia, I see a very strong demand. The other interesting trend I think that will evolve is that with that southern capacity growing, that it will see the feedlot sector in southern Australia grow as well. So all the growth to date has been in the north, namely in Queensland, but I think we'll find that to ensure continuity of supply with that increased capacity, particularly because of the grass-fed nature of the south, I think more feedlot capacity will be required. And as a result of that, you'll get better supply during the winter months in particular, because at the moment it does a lot more seasonal flows in the south. So there's a second trend, Scott, that I see evolving coming going forward is the growth of the feedlot sector in southern Australia.
Interesting. What do you think is driving that processing capacity in South? Simon, what do you think that's strengthening in a more mature market?
I think probably what's driven it has been the evolution of value adding and the second tier operators in Australia, such as Wagyu, but also, you know, managing Angus, but the likes of Jack's Creek, Harmony, all these operators who have really created opportunities for, I think, the quality end of the market. And so what we've seen now with the southern expansion is that those processes are seeing or believing that those opportunities to value add and to really become good at niche at the quality end of the market is there. The opportunities are there going forward. So I think, strangely enough, it was the second tier operators, we call them toll operators, who don't own bricks and mortar, that showed the way for the first tier operators, the owners of those meatworks, to expand and probably try to capture those opportunities themselves as well.
Interesting. It's quite a change. You think with that herd rebuild, we're assuming that weather cycle may have changed for South Australia and Victoria, but that's yet to be seen. It's certainly not a wet spring, but it's a successful spring in terms of water growth. Do you think that as those herds rebuild, can you foresee, like after the 18-19 drought in New South Wales, do you think you'll see cattle from Boss Indicas and Fuse herds in the north heading south? Do you think that's going to be, or is it a domino effect, Simon?
It's a good question, Scott. I think that there's many ways to answer this. First of all, how severely impacted the southern herd was, New South Wales, Victoria, South Australia. So the figures show us that we are at unprecedented record levels of female kill in southern Australia. It's 67.5%. And if you go back to the mid-70s, where data goes back to, this has never, ever happened before. Then if you look at your own data, Scott, on the makeup of the southern herd, 73% of it is Angus. Females of the entire herd in the south is 73% versus 13% in the north. 13% of the northern herd is Angus. 73% of the southern herd is Angus. It's a really important difference. So when that rebuild gets going, we know that it's going to be Victoria, South Australia, and southern New South Wales where the foot to the floor is going to happen. Those were the areas the most decimated. The problem is, if you go back to 2021, when in that year, the size of the herd in New South Wales and the flock went up threefold. So most rebuilds, you know, sit at 4-5% in a good year. In that year, New South Wales was up 15-16% on cattle. Physically impossible. What did they do? They begged, borrowed and stole animals, Scott, from everywhere. Every state they just pulled cattle out of and sheep. And I think in many respects it was a mistake, because Brahmins don't do particularly well in the Riverina. So I think we've learned from the other rebuilds. And so what you'll find is that there will be this drag down from Queensland into northern New South Wales. And I think that that Angus content will be crucial. But will we see from Queensland into southern New South Wales or Victoria? I don't think so. I think the rebuild will come from within for a lot of this. So it points to a longer and a deeper rebuild, and it's got to come from within the Angus community itself to simply beg, borrow and steal from other states. I don't think's able to happen because, one, they're not there, and two, you need the right breeds. So have I answered your question?
Yeah, I think so, Simon. Probably an addition to that question is if those cows aren't there, so if there's not sufficient Angus heifers for that market, can you see some of those producers pivoting into sheep because of the cycle? And do you think that'll compound then the large fluctuations we see in the lamb market? Do you think there's a crossover?
I think there is a little bit of a crossover, but I think that's, you know, in part already happened. Scott, I think that equally, though, there have been a lot of people that exited wool in particular that have either gone into self-shedding sheep or gone into cattle. And I actually think that the flow from wool into cattle and self-shedding sheep is greater than the other way around. So I wouldn't be surprised if, when it comes to the Angus herd and the ownership, that in actual fact, the last 2 to 3 years, it's grown, not got less, because of that migration across from the wool sector in certain parts. So I guess, Scott, overall, the breed and the desire to rebuild is going to come from within. I see the value of those Angus stud stock operations and the value of animals truly increasing as we go forward here.
Interesting, Simon. What we find in Australia here is despite the clean out in Victoria and South Australia, which has had to happen, they have fed stock, but we haven't seen a deterioration across the national Angus female herd, the what we what we're registering, obviously some growth pressure there, but there was, yeah, we haven't seen the national number come back. So that means that our herd sizes in the big Angus state, which is New South Wales, has maintained largely, and also those other areas, it's growing. So it's an interesting one to get a feel for. We'll see. I guess the next 6 months will tell us a lot about how people restock into Victoria.
You bet. The other interesting trend, and I'm talking of recent days and weeks, is that when we go through drought and the last, 2018 and 19, but in reality, 23, late 23, 24, and then the start of this year. But there was a serious problem with debt because people borrowed a lot of money and therefore had to keep feeding their animals, and therefore the debt levels rose. So often what you see is the rain comes and yet the high liquidation continues, Scott, because people have to pay down debt. So, in 2020, great example, the rains fell in January, yet we didn't start rebuilding until September, October that year. I would argue this year the rains have come probably June, July. I don't think we start rebuilding until the first quarter of next year. But what's interesting is that in recent days, when I've spoken to those second-tier lenders that are part of what we do at Global Agritrends and to the banks, those debt levels have reduced. There is now money sitting on the sideline ready to be used to step back in the market. So right now, and quote unquote from some of these lenders, we're one rain event away from people stepping back into the market and restocking, but also rebuilding. So what's really interesting is that debt levels in the last month or two, because of the higher cattle prices, have been reduced significantly, and now the market is getting ready to reload again. And I think Angus will be a huge part of that.
Interesting, Simon. Look, that's certainly probably some fairly welcome news for people in the Angus business. Let's zoom out a little bit, Simon. Change tack now and talk about the larger global beef market. We know that it's very strong. At the present time, we're all aware of what's going on in the US. We've seen good prices this year, come back a little bit just lately. But from a global beef context, how would you describe the current market in a few words, Simon? Yeah, how would you describe it?
Yeah, I think it is strong. What's fascinating to me is that the strength of that market, due to Donald Trump and tariffs, has become even greater. And I'll give you four quick examples of how that's happened, Scott. One, tariffs are inflationary. It drove domestic prices up in America, which in turn has lifted offering prices in Japan, Korea, all over the world. Who's their number one competitor in these markets? We are. So who has benefited from higher domestic prices in America that's felt across the world is Australia, thanks to Donald Trump. Number two example, China. America has no access for beef into China as we speak because they did not renew the licenses back in March, thanks to Donald Trump and the trade war. China has become once again crucial for Australia. So we are seeing incredibly good prices for Angus into China. Example number three, Brazil. Tariffs now sit at 50% into America. You add the out-of-quota duty of 26.4%. Brazil is facing 76.4%, and shipments out of Brazil into America have dried up. Once again, Australia is providing, in particular, lean beef into that market because Brazil cannot afford the tariffs of 76.4%. Once again, thanks to Donald Trump, we're a winner.
And Simon, with the Brazilian beef, where's it going now?
It is going into China and also into the Middle East. So they've truly picked up their game. and we're starting to see it in parts of Southeast Asia. Indonesia's seeing a lot more flow, the Philippines as well. So it's a little bit everywhere else except America. But keep in mind that they move into a rebuild themselves next year. So this is the last hurrah from Brazil until they too, like us and like North America, will move into rebuild.
Did you see your comments? Really, those tariffs and President Trump have been, you know, good news for the Australian beef industry, hasn't it?
It has. Yeah. And until you step through it, a lot of people are surprised just how much they truly have assisted us on so many levels.
And Simon, if you just thinking a bit more broadly, and you've certainly been optimistic about the Australian beef industry for a bit of time now. You're pretty bullish there. What sort of underpins that overall general confidence? Certainly we've got the American situation, but yeah, what are some of those big issues?
I think it is a combination of just the fact that America, South America and Australia are about to go into a rebuild, which is the first time in my living memory that's ever occurred, Scott. So with a rebuild comes female retention and tightening of supply, and that therefore lifts markets and prices everywhere. So it's rare in this world that happens. It begs the question, though, what happens once we all rebuild? What lies on the other side, Scott, in 4 or 5 years' time? I truly believe, and this goes back to your question on trends, that rebuild of herds globally will not be what they were. And the sheep sector as well, the flock, I don't think we ever regrow them back to their same size. In actual fact, America is at a 65-year low, but in reality, carcass weights make up for fewer numbers. And when you can see that carcass weights in Australia, you know, 20 years ago, we averaged around about, 270, 280, and today 330 is closer to the peak of the market. So overall, Scott, my point being is that we will not see, I think, the numbers like we did 5 years ago, 10 years ago, when this rebuild is finished. What will happen is carcass weights will continue to grow, and that will make up for some of the shortfalls. What it also does, though, is fewer cows are required in the system, and therefore it leads to other more complex problems of less 90s available globally when overall herd sizes fall but carcass weights increase. So where am I going with all this? Is that it is going to get tighter in the short term over the next 3 to 4 years, and prices will move higher. I expect them to peak next year, driven mainly by North America and that quality end of the market. I see somewhere between 25 to 30% upside from where we are today in pricing in America.
That's interesting, Simon. There is a lot of factors going on there. I watched with interest a slide that you often show people where every time there's a cattle cycle in the US, there's a decline in the cow herd over a long period of time because there's some competing factors for land to run those cows on.
It's a very good point.
It's an interesting one, Simon. There's no way of pulling that up, is there, that trend?
Well, we were good at monitoring that, and once again, our Australian Bureau of Statistics, their funds were cut, and so that information is getting harder and harder to get. But we've just got to look to New Zealand as a great example where forestry is taking over farmland. And each year we're seeing less cattle and sheep in the system, and we're seeing farmland go into forestry. And Scott, you can't turn that around that quickly. I think also that we've got to look to not just forestry, but even carbon farming and management of soils. What we're learning is that stocking rates in many situations are being lowered to better manage, I guess, soils and the carbon. So I think there are trends everywhere that point to less numbers in the system, Scott.
Simon, on that, one of the other big trends we hear all about, it's chatter, is beef on dairy. We've got the dairy industry globally. It's grown on the back of consumer demand, and we've got animal welfare ethics issues. So we're seeing the growth in beef on dairy. How much of a hole can beef on dairy plug the system with, Simon? Is it the saviour, or is there a finite global capacity that we can't go past?
I think it's a great question. I think that it is in part a solution to the problem. And I think America is, you know, a great example. You know, if you went back 10 years ago, Scott, it made up 7 to 8% of supply of production. Today, it sits closer, as I understand, to 18 to 20%. Mm. And I would guess that within the next 5 years, maybe less, it'll be closer to 25% of US production.
That's a big number, Simon.
It is a big number. And I think, you know, it fixes lots of problems at once. You know, potty calves, you know, the euthanizing of potty calves and that animal welfare side of it, there is no doubt, having recently visited in Bega some calf feeding operations, and I think, you know, I think the move by your organization to relook at this definition of Angus, that 50% content, goes a long way to helping assist in making those calf rearing operations profitable. Whereas in the past, they've struggled because it's been difficult to get the premium required to justify that rearing cost. So I think it does remain crucial. I think that steps that your organization have made are very positive and goes a long way in helping an animal welfare problem, but also creating additional supply that I think will be needed in the future.
No, thanks, Simon. One of the troubles with asking you questions on a podcast is every time you answer one, I've got another one in my mind that I'd like to go down the rabbit hole with. Just before we move on from the bigger markets, and the comments on dairy beef are very important, can you talk to me a little bit about the minor markets, Simon? So we've got our big four markets, which is fine. What are you seeing in terms of the importance of high quality beef into your ASEAN markets, your Middle East markets? I gather that we're selling into more international markets than ever before. What's the importance for the minor markets like Singapore and Hong Kong and those that are small populations but high value? Yeah, how do you see that fitting in?
And so the Middle East is a great example where they've become crucial for the loin. So that's the ribeye, the strip loin, and the tenderloin. And so they have air freighting is what goes on the majority of the time, but they've stepped up and they're willing to pay an absolute premium for the product. And what it does is when it comes to tenderloins and strips, and they make up 41, 42% of the carcass value. So take that all the way into the paddock, they are the three cuts that make the difference to your animal's value. So the Middle East has provided this unique outlet at premium prices, and it keeps the meat away from oversupplying America, Japan, Korea, and others. So what we've learned in the Middle East is you've got to manage supply well, because the last thing you want to do is oversupply the Middle East and therefore, if you'll excuse the expression, shit in your own backyard. So you need to ensure that you keep the supply up but not oversupply that market, but it's become crucial. And I think we then look to Europe as another great example, Scott. I mean, the agreement on beef into Europe is clunky. We're still trying to negotiate a grain-fed portion of our access, the Hilton quota. Everything is difficult. But what we do know is that the premiums in Europe are outstanding and will continue to be so. Then the third one is the UK itself, where it too has, I think, really evolved thanks to the free trade agreement. And I think, you know, we are having actually quite filled our quota there, But each year we're increasing the volumes, and I think this year we get close to 25,000 tonnes into that market. But more importantly, it's the lack of supply out of Ireland because of their requirements under EU and the regulations to meet their carbon footprint and lowering emissions, that they have actually started contracting the herd size in Ireland. As a result, their supply into both Europe and into the UK has dried up and getting less. And in actual fact, Europe is probably outbidding the UK, and therefore Australia's opportunity into the UK is due to the lack of Irish beef. And that is going to get greater, that lack of Irish beef, and increase pricing and opportunities for Australia in that market.
An interesting one, that UK free trade agreement, Simon. And I was speaking with Mick Crowley on the podcast. Obviously, that was a great opportunity for Australia, the free trade agreement in the UK. We're going to see the tonnage grow over a number of years. You see a point where it returns to that sizable market like the big four are. Do you think it's going to grow?
I think we cap out at 110,000. So it doesn't quite get to where the big four are at. But I think what it does, and particularly if we get the benefits into Europe, that we're hoping that both Europe and the UK combined will be part of the big four, if you know what I mean. So I think that the two will complement each other when we finally get Europe right. And it will be about, I think, the quality end of the market. So on its own, it may not be meeting all those requirements, but together with Europe, I think it, collectively, it will be two very, very important markets for Australia.
That's interesting, Simon. On a couple of recent trips to Europe in the last couple of years, they've obviously got an issue in their meat grading system, and it rewards yield, essentially, and volume. But what I noticed there was there's a huge growth in Angus cattle across the Europe continent, and particularly in Eastern Europe. Seems to be that there's a secondary market there for quality, and their Angus cousins in Europe are supplying directly into restaurants and high-value chains and bypassing that reward on yield by their processes. There's an underlying trend, I think, Simon, isn't there, towards quality that the market's...
Without doubt. And dare I say, marble score, marble score, and marble score are the three things that really, you know, I think are driving that quality end of the market. So whether we like it or not, what we've seen with America and the lack of supply because of their rebuild, but what's happened is that America, to me, has opened the opportunity for Australian Angus globally because people have got a taste of that American prime in particular, and Australia can offer, I think, the equivalent with our own Angus. So America, you might say, has gone out and paved the way. And as they retreat and we backfill, we're going to be backfilling with, I think, equally good quality Angus that America was supplying.
Interesting. Simon, you've been around this game for a while. You've watched the China bubble come and go and then come back. Obviously, we're just benefiting at the moment from the Americans being cut out of the market. But we did see under a previous government that we had restrictions into China. What's your thinking longer term? How does that play out with market access for Australia? Does it depend on which government's in at the time, Simon? Is it all politics, or what's your longer term thoughts there?
It's a really good question, Scott. And I've watched China firsthand for a long time. Dare I say, I was in Tiananmen Square the day the tanks rolled in by chance. So I truly have watched closely at a personal level the politics there.
You were actually in the square the day.
We'd been there that day. The tanks came in at 2 a.m. And at that point in time, we were on a train from Beijing to Shanghai. But we'd met with the students that day and had been meeting with them for an entire week. So we were in and out of the square amongst all the build-up and everything. So, yes, that's for another day. But mercy flights out of China at the time, it was an extraordinary moment to be there.
That's one of history's great moment, Simon, and we will have to have a chat over another meal about that. That's quite extraordinary. And I guess then that gives you that first-hand experience. So, yeah, I'll let you continue with you. Where do you think it's going?
So I think that we went through some pretty awful years and under the ScoMo government and predecessors where China was the political football. You know, that was the point scoring exercise that we did in Australian politics. And things had deteriorated to a point that, you know, even Andrew Robb, who had done all the hard work in establishing these free trade agreements, we'd all wake up and go, what now? You know, effectively, we were undoing all the hard work of the previous Liberal government in Australia. I think when Albanese came to power, and also we got the new Chinese ambassador, that things changed quickly for the better. So we then got, you know, those 6 or 7 plants reinstated in terms of their licenses into China. And I think we brought relations back to being on track. So let's give credit where credit's due. This is, you know, I'm politically indifferent, but I see that things improved dramatically under the Albanese government. I'd like to think that that continues, that we will never go back to what we were doing under that previous government, using it as a political football, because we need China. And China, I think, needs us. What's interesting is how big an impact the 100% duty or tariff that Trump has on China. So when we talk about the impact of Trump and tariffs, our biggest concern is what it does to our key markets. So thankfully, Japan and Korea went from 25% tariff down to 15%, and they avoided recession. And therefore, they could continue to buy Australian beef, and we kind of dodged the bullet in terms of their recession. So the same holds for China. Is the most important thing to me is resolving these differences on tariffs so that they avoid recession and continue to buy our beef and our lamb. So they're my underlying concerns. Often we think about tariffs and what it just means to us, but it's actually equally important that our key markets have got tariffs that they can manage and can continue to thrive under.
And Simon, there was a lot of chatter at the time as a risk mitigation strategy for our beef brands in Australia to broaden their markets. So we're a bit exposed when some certain things happen with China and that caused a lot of issues. Are you still seeing that broadening of a market base from processors? Are they, you know, got one eye to the left and the right going forward? Are they making sure they've got a greater diversity of markets? Is that still a trend or not?
Yeah, I think it is. But I think, Scott, from my point of view, when we define diversifying, mostly you think about other countries. And yet in actual fact, diversification to me is also up and down the supply chain. So value adding is equally important in diversification. And the truth is we've been in all these global markets 40, 50 years. There are not many markets we're not in. But what we're doing is value adding. And I think one of the best examples is TFI, who are truly investing in North America, in, you know, value adding in North America. They've got large factory operations and they are reaching out, not at the wholesale level, but at the retail level. And we see that everywhere. So the word diversification, I think Australia is embracing, but not in the traditional sense, but in the sense of bringing more to the market and value adding.
Interesting. Interesting. So what do our guys, our Angus breeders need to be? What should they have in order for the next couple of years? So I'm only thinking market trends.
I think that what we're going to see is that there will be a rebuild here. You know, what lies on the other side? And I think that we're going to find what I call the new norm, where pricing will go from today, let's call it $5 to $5.50. By the end of next year, we'll get to the 750 that we've spoken about. So November, December, I see a lift in global markets and I see the impact of the rebuild here, particularly in the South. And between those two factors, it will drive prices. 750 is unsustainable. But what happens in any rebuild, you go up 30% and you come down 30% as the numbers start to build. But where we land is the other key thing here, Scott. We're not going back to 450. We're not going back to $4. We will land back right here again at $5 to $5.50, I think in 2028. And we stay there until 2033 and thereafter. And I call that the new norm. Because of high input costs, we need prices at these levels just to be sustainable for our businesses. But also inflation globally is on the rise. And overall herd sizes are getting smaller globally. And I think that we are really going to settle at what I call the new norm post the rebuild and up and down that we'll see. But I think that we will see sustainable prices going forward. And therefore, with that in mind, I think that the Angus space will remain a good one and that people, I think, with confidence can continue to invest in it.
Just to dig in that to that a little bit, Simon, you've been a great supporter of the Angus breed. What is it about that Angus cow base that you think gives produces positivity for the future?
I think it's because it's the cornerstone of Australia and globally, you know, a rebuild. And so by that, I mean that it's not just pure Angus that we're talking about, but when you go to other breeds, or crossbreeding, but the need to increase productivity, Angus is the go-to every time. And whether you're in the Wagyu space or flatbacks in the north, whatever, Angus continually steps in and fills the void to be part of that crossbreeding F1 program, you name it. So to me, that's the uniqueness about the Angus breed, is that it continually is part of almost every other breed in terms of reaching numbers, getting the quality, getting the hybrid vigor, getting the marbling, whatever's required at the time, you're going to get it from your Angus.
It's very positive, Bobby Solomon. You'll be very welcome at our conferences going forward with a good, solid message like that with our members, Simon. That's great. What do you think, Simon? What do we need to learn as a breed? And what do we need to be? Is there anything we're not getting right? What do we need to be thinking about that we're not? Or is there, how can we improve the herd, Simon?
Okay, so you have asked me a question that I will answer, and I hope this is to your liking. But we go down the path of defining the Angus breed as 50% content. I think that we need to be part of that process to introduce other categories of defining Angus, and that is that we have a potentially a 75% content and a 90% content, because there are people within the organization that have produced quality animals that truly should be rewarded for that reason. And so, you know, we call it a full blood Angus, a pure blood Angus, but nonetheless, that then brings clarity, not just to the breeding side of things, but to the marketing side. So that when we go into the market, we can now offer a uniqueness about the product. So there will be opportunities. If you can continually producing 75% more content, there is a premium in the market for that. And at 90% content, an even larger premium. So I want more clarity. I want more definition in the market. And I want those that have exceptional breeds or quality genetics within the Angus society that they get truly rewarded for it.
That's a good point, Simon. I think that's what we've certainly been pushing for. And as we We don't sit on the label and standards committee with those, mate, but they keep us up to date with some of those changes. And I believe they've got some revisions with the Department of Agriculture, Forests and Fisheries at the moment, and there'll be some determination shortly. So we watch that space very closely, as you do, Simon. And you're right, we've got those labels of beef in the Angus world that have been supporting high content Angus for a long time. And we certainly hope that there's plenty of good definition and then an objective measurement going forward that supports those brands. So we're certainly watching that space very closely as well. So I have a couple of questions for you just to close off, I guess. You've had an amazing career in the industry. I recently, somebody said that your life was defined not by a number of years, but by key moments in your life, and your career can be defined that way as well. And they suggested that there's only 100 defining moments in your life that defines a life. You had a pivotal moment in your career working in the beef industry. Is there one or two that stand out for you, Simon, as pivotal change moments?
Yeah, good question. I would say, and this once again is a slightly controversial answer. So if you cast your mind back to the early 2000s, where we did not have access into North America or the USA the way we do today, and that we had a situation where the industry was divided over access to America. And so we had what we call those that had open market access and those that were very specific in what they produced. And each one said, we deserve quota and you don't. And as a result of that, the industry was divided. I sat with the group that was about making sure we exported globally to every possible destination. And then if you did that well, you were rewarded for access into America. And I headed up that group, and I would have had half to two-thirds of Australia's meat processors working behind me. And at the time, we won that debate or outcome. And it was probably a pivotal moment, I think, in Australia's meat industry, ensuring that America's access remained as open as possible. Later on, under Howard, we then lifted the entire access anyway with one of the most amazing agreements. But I think the principle was the right one at the time, ensuring that Australian processors and farmers work their hardest at trying to get every market open to themselves, that we try to access every market. And by working hard globally, if there is specific requirements, that you should be rewarded for it, but it should be done in a fair way. Hopefully I've described that the best way I can, but the legacy of that outcome is with us today.
Interesting, Simon. That's a good reflection. What's the most memorable beef eating experience that you've had? I imagine you've had quite a few.
I'm going to say everyone's memorable. Look, I think it just depends on which part of the world you're in. And it's funny, isn't it? You go to Korea and you have Korean barbecue, and it's the best meal you've ever had at the time. You try to do the same at home back in Australia to have a Korean barbecue. It never tastes quite as good, does it?
No,
it doesn't. You go to Japan and you have beautiful, you know, sliced up steak, and it's just gorgeous, and yet we can't quite get it right. So I'm going to say that it truly is everywhere where I've had that best experience. And being in market and experiencing it there and being part of it, everyone is memorable. So I know I'm not giving you the answer you want, but all it does is encourage me, and I encourage others, to go and be part of these markets that you sell to, either directly or indirectly, because truly, each time you go to these markets, it's the best Angus or meat you've ever had, and there's nothing like being in the market to taste it.
That's great, Simon. Perhaps I should have asked you, what's your best Indian buffalo eating experience?
Can I say the last time that I had Indian buffalo, the sheets lifted that evening in my bed for all the wrong
reasons.
That's
great, Simon. Yeah, that's wonderful. And Simon, the last question I've got for you today is what keeps you excited about this industry?
It's a good question. I think seeing the young talent coming through, and I think Jen Angus is really an extraordinary event. I think now I've had 5 years involvement, the young people, the young talent that I keep re-meeting at other events that have been born out of that Jen Angus program really is a compliment to what Angus Australia has done. So to answer your question, seeing that the future is being handed, I think, to some pretty good young hands, and that it's incredibly exciting that we've got these new young talent coming through.
Well, thanks, Simon. I would agree. I think there's some wonderful young people in our industry. Certainly the days where people were scared that there was no young people coming into the industry are long gone. I think we're seeing enthusiasm and young people very excited about the future, which is great. And I think a reflection, which we appreciate, Simon, is often some of our Jen Angus candidates will say, well, Simon comes along, he sits in the back of the room, he has a bit of a think about, gets to know the candidates that are on the course. You don't just come in as a presenter and leave. You really like to get to know the team, and it's much appreciated. Look, great to have you on this morning on the Angus Table, Simon. You're a great friend of the Angus breed. Your insights are fantastic. A lot of research in the background. We know it's not an easy job, and you put your head on the block a lot, Simon, with some pretty ballsy forecasts. So thanks for being willing to come on and have a chat this morning.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us today. We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Angus Table. We look forward to bringing you more conversations that support your success in the Angus breed and your farming operation.
I'm Scott Wright, CEO of Angus Australia, and today's Angus Table podcast is produced by Mel Strasberg.
Until next time, all the best.